38-year-old Sandra Solly had always wanted to be a mother, so when she discovered she was pregnant, her elation was immeasurable. In the spring of 1994, the Macedon, New York resident was 7 months pregnant and looking forward to her baby shower. Unfortunately, she would mysteriously vanish just weeks before. On the morning of May 23rd, Sandra ran some errands and then returned home. What transpired afterward remains a mystery with few clues. When investigators searched her home, all that was missing besides Sandy herself were her purse and her beloved poodle. Days later, investigators learned her credit cards were being used by someone in nearby Rochester. Right around the same time, they found Sandra's purse in a dumpster. Over the years, police have extensively searched the woods and a nearby canal to no avail. A private investigator has dedicated his life to trying to solve the case, while Sandra's family is determined to find the truth sooner or later. While some believe the answers may lie close to home, for others, the truth of the child's paternity could unlock the entire mystery. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 141, The Disappearance of Sandra Solly. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine a truly disturbing disappearance from upstate New York. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also available on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon available at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions directly through the website or email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Sandra Solly had always wanted to be a mother, and finally her wish was coming true. Then one warm spring afternoon, someone stole that dream from her and stole Sandy from everyone. This is episode 141, The Disappearance of Sandra Solly. On the morning of Thursday, June 2nd, 1994, Macedon Police Chief John Ellis pulled up to the duplex just off Route 350 and found the owner, Jay Whiting, waiting for him. Whiting had called in a report of concern earlier in the day. One of his tenants, Sandra Solly, was late paying her rent, something that was completely out of character for the 38-year-old. Concerned, Whiting requested a welfare check, and Ellis had come to perform that duty. Sandra's car, a gold-colored Honda, sat in the driveway, and aside from a few open windows, the doors to her apartment were locked. Whiting produced a key, and together the men walked inside. There didn't seem to be anything out of place. No signs of a struggle or robbery. In fact, the only things that were noted as being missing were Sandra's purse and her beloved poodle, Jesse. Not seeing any major cause for alarm, Chief Ellis decided that they should leave the apartment and wait a few days to see if Sandra turned up. It was a tepid response, especially when held in comparison to another case, happening just 20 miles to the west in Rochester. 10 days earlier, 4-year-old Kaylee Ann Poulton had vanished from her family's townhouse complex while riding her tricycle. A massive conglomeration of police and local volunteers had been conducting extensive searches all throughout the area, searches which had been kicked off within an hour of the child's May 23rd disappearance. There were, of course, differences, and for investigators, the key was age. 4-year-olds don't and can't just go off on their own, but a 38-year-old woman has every right to come and go as she pleases, or at least that's the argument that was made at the time. Of course, there was one detail about Sandra Solly that made her case a little different. She was 7 months pregnant. After the June 2nd visit, police didn't seem to think much about Sandra's absence, having found nothing to suggest anything criminal had occurred. Three more days would pass before one of Sandra's friends, a tenant renting the downstairs apartment, reached out to the missing woman's parents. She had grown concerned about Sandra and hadn't seen her for well over a week. As it turned out, none of Sandra's friends or relatives had heard from her either, and what was initially dismissed as a woman off doing her own thing would quickly become a complicated and frustrating mystery. When investigators did finally manage to narrow down the last time anyone could confirm seeing Sandra, it turned out that she may have vanished on the exact same day as Kaylee Poulton. An investigation would be kicked into high gear, but they were already 2 weeks behind. Sandra Ann Savone was born on December 10, 1955, to parents Dominic and Nancy. Sandy, as she was often called, was the youngest of five siblings and was described as a bright, bubbly person who loved to laugh. Sandy grew up in Oakfield, a small town in Genesee County. Tina Fredo, who had become friends with Sandy at a young age, described her to the Daily News, saying, quote, "She's caring, giving, loving, and would and did anything for anyone, no matter who you were. You don't find many people like that," end quote. Sandy attended Oakfield, Alabama Central School, where teachers described her as a good student, though one who was frequently admonished for being a little too chatty. As Sandy grew older, she began to envision a future with her own family. She was extremely close with her sister, Donna, who told Rochester First News that the two went to school together, shared clothes, and of course, gossiped about boys. According to Donna, Sandy always wanted to be a mother, and when she married Ralph Solly Jr., she thought that dream was finally going to come true. In 1989, things took a different turn. When Sandy was in her early 30s, she and Ralph divorced. Not long after, Ralph would remarry, interestingly enough, to a woman who had once been Sandy's hairstylist. There was, reportedly, a lot of tension between Sandy and Ralph, which you might expect coming out of a divorce. Some of that tension, though, had to do with at least one ruling made during their divorce. According to an article in the Democrat and Chronicle, Ralph was required to pay for Sandy's car, to which he officially held the title. By the spring of 1994, Sandra was single and living in the upstairs apartment of the duplex off Route 350. She had moved in not long after the divorce. She didn't live alone, though, as she shared that space with her beloved charcoal poodle, Jesse. Sandy was employed by the Eastman Kodak Company, though she was out of work and living on disability as the result of an accident which had occurred at the business. Reportedly, Sandy sustained a head injury which had caused her to experience repetitive, painful headaches. However, there was one bright light when it came to Sandy's physical health, and that was her pregnancy. She had become pregnant in the late stages of 1993, and by May, she was nearing her 7th month, with her due date set to be August 15th. According to friends and family, Sandy changed dramatically when she learned she was pregnant. Her brother Ron told the Democrat and Chronicle that she had become like a new person, with her life now completely focused around her soon-to-be firstborn, a boy who she'd already decided to name Brandon Michael. Sandy began purchasing everything she'd need to raise her son and went through with converting a room of her apartment into a full nursery. She also started seeing doctors regularly for prenatal visits and was trying to do everything she could to ensure a healthy pregnancy. Her excitement was palpable, with friends noting how eager she was to become a mother. In the weeks leading up to her disappearance, Sandy's family brought up the possibility of a baby shower. According to Donna, Sandy was interested but needed to figure out a good time to schedule it. Ultimately, the date was set for Sunday, June 12th. While the excitement for the shower was growing, it would sadly never happen, as Sandy would go missing more than 2 weeks before the date. Not a great deal is known about the last day Sandy was seen, but what few details exist present a small timeline which investigators have followed since the beginning. It was the morning of Monday, May 23rd, and Sandy had several errands she was looking to take care of. We know that Sandy had to drive to the town of Newark, approximately 13 miles to the west, to pick up a prescription. Heading back towards Macedon, she stopped in the Ames Plaza Shopping Center, known today as the West Wayne Plaza, to do a little shopping in a department store. At some point, she also stopped at a secondhand shop to drop off clothing she was looking to get rid of. Sandy later picked up Ed Miller, an elderly man she'd befriended. Oftentimes, Sandy would take Miller out so that he could run his own errands. Ed Miller is listed as one of the last people to see Sandy alive, telling investigators that she was at her home at the duplex at approximately 2:30 p.m. There is one other person who reported seeing Sandy that day, her ex-husband Ralph Solly. According to an interview in the Democrat and Chronicle, Ralph stated that he had seen and spoken with Sandy during the morning hours in relation to an issue she was having with her car. While Ralph doesn't mention any issues or arguments taking place that day, private investigator Richard Ingram later told Rochester First News, quote, "They had an argument, and they were fighting over the car and money and things like that," end quote. As we get more into the details of the investigation, this interaction between Sandy and Ralph will come more and more under scrutiny. No one knows exactly what happened after 2:30. In fact, there wouldn't be any contact with police until 10 days later. During that week and a half, Sandy was missing. No one saw her at home, around town, and she would go on to miss two doctor's appointments. According to several articles, Sandy didn't always find it necessary to be in constant contact with friends and family. It wasn't unheard of for her to go several days or even a week without calling or checking in, so it seems that during this period, no one had any particular reason to be concerned. In fact, it appears most people assumed that while they hadn't heard from her, surely someone else had. May 23rd was also the day that 4-year-old Kaylee Poulton went missing from nearby Rochester. Kaylee's face was splashed all over the headlines. Local news produced extensive coverage, and police from all around the state and federal agencies were heavily involved with massive search efforts. The child was abducted sometime after 6:50 p.m. while riding her tricycle in the front yard. At the time, everyone was a suspect, and considering when the crime had occurred, police theorized it was likely someone who lived in the area or knew it well. While the search for Kaylee continued to build steam, just 10 miles to the east, Sandy's own absence was hardly noted. On June 2nd, Jay Whiting contacted police regarding his tenant of 5 years. According to him, it was completely out of character for Sandy to be late with her payment and to not be around. Despite trying to get in touch with her multiple times, there was never an answer to the phone or to knocks at the door. It was strange, to say the least. When Chief John Ellis arrived to look around, he didn't see anything which screamed to him that there was an emergency. The apartment was in good shape, the car was parked in the driveway, and the only things missing were Sandy, her purse, and of course her poodle. 3 days later, after receiving calls from both Sandy's neighbor and family about her absence, Macedon police, in conjunction with the state police, launched an investigation. A thorough examination of Sandy's apartment again didn't note much out of the ordinary, although there was one bizarre detail. While the apartment was locked, and so was her car, Sandy's keys were found inside. Since her dog and the leash were missing, investigators speculated that Sandy likely left the apartment of her own volition, but planned to return. Canvassing of the area didn't turn up any witnesses who had seen Sandy after the 23rd, and so it was assumed she may have gone to take the dog for a walk that night, and something happened. Sandy was known to walk the dog along the Erie Canal, which was just a few hundred yards from the apartment. Beyond the canal, there was a lot of dense forestry in the area, and so search efforts would initially focus within a mile or so of the apartment before expanding outward. Searches were launched on land, water, and air. Helicopters hovered above the canal and wooded areas. Police on foot and on ATVs covered the landscape from the ground, while divers went into the canal to look for any trace of Sandy, but nothing was found. The search focused primarily in Wayne County, although police did send a smaller faction to search in the Rochester area. While some were out searching, others were working to track down Sandy's contacts. Police were going through her address book, entry by entry, in hopes that they would find someone who had seen the 38-year-old in recent days. They conducted interviews with every name they came across and anyone who had left a message on Sandy's answering machine during the time that she had been missing. Senior investigator William Bowling ultimately told the media that while they had found no hard evidence, they believed Sandy's disappearance was suspicious. Bowling's feelings were later galvanized when an examination of Sandy's financial records brought up some curious behavior. In the days following her disappearance, her credit card had been used 14 times between Thursday the 26th and Tuesday the 31st. There were no attempted charges in the month of June. The charges all stemmed out of the greater Rochester area and were for items no one believed Sandy could be shopping for herself. Nearly $300 was charged at a men's clothing store, while other charges included purchases of beer and cigarettes. It was a break, for a time, with police reaching out to shop owners and employees looking for descriptions. It turned out that, on several occasions, the same three men were seen together shopping with Sandy's card. Two of the stores where purchases were made had surveillance cameras, so it was hoped authorities might get a look at their potential suspects. Days after the initial report came in, police received word that Sandy's card had been used by a fourth person, a woman in this case, who had made purchases at a clothing store and a pharmacy. Because of this new information, state police moved their base of operations from Macedon to Rochester. Investigator Bowling later explained that they had gotten their hands on the two surveillance tapes, one of which offered no assistance. Police also sent word out to local dog groomers and veterinarians to be on the lookout for a dog fitting Jessie's description, noting that she wore a blue canvas collar. They also told local hospitals to keep an eye out for any pregnant women that came in who fit Sandy's description. On Saturday, June 11th, investigators were able to positively identify the three men who had been using Sandy's card, noting to reporters that they were Rochester residents in their 20s. The identity of the woman was, as of that time, unknown. While police were tracking down the three men, they received a report of a dog seen floating along the Genesee River. Investigators managed to locate the dog near the Stutson Street Bridge, but upon retrieving it from the river, they were able to rule it out as being Jessie. 3 days later, on Tuesday the 14th, investigator Bowling publicly announced that they now believe Sandy was likely the victim of foul play, noting that she had missed her own baby shower, and it was considered highly unlikely she would have done so if she had had the ability to attend. Bowling also explained that investigators had been sent to search two new areas, one being near the Panorama Plaza in the town of Penfield, some 14 miles to the northwest, as well as near the intersection of Hudson Avenue and Reed Park in Rochester. According to the Democrat and Chronicle, police managed to track down and interrogate the three men who had been using Sandy's card. During their interview, the men explained that they had been given the card by a friend. That friend, in turn, expressed that he had received the card from his son, who had found Sandy's wallet lying in a row of hedges near North Street, one block over from Hudson. The men all admitted to using the card illegally, but claimed to have no connection to Sandy's disappearance. According to investigators, the men were very cooperative and even led police to the child and family who had recovered the wallet. Police were fairly quick to determine that the men were likely not involved in Sandy's disappearance. While the credit thieves had led police to specific areas of Rochester, different information led researchers to the area near Panorama Plaza. Two particular pieces of evidence were recovered from a car wash. Sandy's purse and Jessie's dog collar and tags were found in a dumpster behind the business. That dumpster was often filled by trash cans accessible to patrons, and so it was believed that whoever abducted Sandy may have gone through the car wash in order to clean evidence from their vehicle. For a period of time, police had been working on a theory that Sandy had likely gotten into a car with someone she knew, and that person was responsible for her disappearance. It was noted that her dog Jessie wasn't friendly to people she didn't know, so it simply wouldn't make sense for her to bring her dog along with a total stranger. Based on the location of the items found, it seemed to show a trajectory, with the suspect leaving Macedon heading west through Penfield and then ultimately into Rochester. The media around this time started noting the differences between the search for Sandy and the search for Kaylee. While Kaylee's face was on flyers all over the state, and investigators were receiving well over 200 tips per day, Sandy's face wasn't anywhere, and tips were barely trickling in. Police had set up a checkpoint near Kaylee's home to stop passersby for questioning, but that hadn't been done near Sandy's residence. Investigator Bowling seemed somewhat dismissive of the comparison, explaining, quote, "Her friends were calling on the answering machine looking for her. You're talking 10 days before anything was even moved on this one. In 2 weeks, she could have hitchhiked to California. You have a 38-year-old woman who is 7 months pregnant. If she is out there, we'd know about it real soon." End quote. By the last week of June, investigators were already running out of avenues to examine, and so they turned their focus back towards those who knew and were closest to Sandy. Dominic and Nancy, Sandy's parents, moved into her duplex apartment shortly after she disappeared. It was their hope that by being close to the area, they could be of more assistance to police, and if Sandy came back, they'd be there to welcome her. Understandably, the passing of time only added more frustration and pain for them, but they hoped investigators would be able to find something, even with so little evidence. When asked about the investigation, Dominic replied, quote, "They're looking in every nook and cranny, but what leads are there? We're looking for the good, but sometimes you think of other things. It's a tough one." End quote. Investigators once again took to the skies, launching a helicopter search which would cover areas between Sandy's apartment and the car wash where her purse was found. Unfortunately, they weren't able to locate anything to advance their search. On June 22nd, Investigator Bowling told reporters that the detectives assigned to Sandy's case had been decreased from 12 to 4. In response, Sandy's family announced a $10,000 reward available for anyone who called in information which would lead to their daughter's location. Despite this, the case began growing cold. In early July, Sandy's friend Sandra Krawicki began a major push to bring more publicity to the case. Krawicki noted that while there were posters of Kaylee everywhere, it was hard to locate even one of Sandy, even in Macedon. Through her efforts, she managed to get Sandy's employer, Eastman Kodak, to fund the production of 1,000 missing persons flyers for distribution, but she remained frustrated at the discrepancy between the two cases, saying, quote, "I'm angry there's not as much media coverage for Sandy as for Kaylee. It's almost like Sandy's story was tucked away and forgotten." End quote. Investigator Bowling noted that people are always going to be more concerned about the welfare of a child, though even he noticed that Kaylee's case was much more active than Sandy's, telling the Democrat and Chronicle, quote, "They get more leads in 3 days than I'm getting in this whole investigation." End quote. While Kaylee's case had received more than 2,000 tips, Bowling had only had 170 to work for Sandy. On Wednesday, July 6th, police in the town of Newark, where Sandy had gone to the pharmacy the day she vanished, received an anonymous tip from a caller who claimed to have seen a woman's body floating down the Erie Canal. 4 state police divers went into the canal in the area specified for more than 6 hours, but never found anything. Investigators later made an appeal for the caller to call back in and give them a more specific location, but that never happened. While at the time, police didn't believe the call was a prank, they never were able to locate any human remains along the canal. In the meantime, Krawicki had more flyers produced and spread from Macedon to Rochester, up into areas surrounding Buffalo, as well as down south all along the eastern seaboard. But again, few tips came in, and the case continued growing cold. August brought a painful date for Sandy's family. As the 15th passed, they couldn't help but acknowledge that that was the week Sandy's son was supposed to arrive. While the family hoped to be celebrating a new life, they were instead frightened of mourning 2 deaths. Sandy's sister-in-law, Kathy, when speaking to the media, explained, quote, "This is the delivery week. It has kind of sparked up more emotions. It's just been a real tough week. We're still hoping that something comes up, were just hanging in there, day by day. End quote. Throughout the early months of the investigation, time and time again, police noted that they were eager to determine the identity of the man who had fathered Sandy's child. It's somewhat bizarre how, all throughout coverage of this case, it doesn't come up very often, at least not as much as you'd imagine, since this would be a person who many would suspect could have a motive for Sandy's disappearance. The Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene conducted a study between 1993 and 1998. According to their results, homicide is the leading cause of death for pregnant women, accounting for up to 20% of their deaths. Perhaps the reason comes down to the fact that no one's been able to legally prove who the father was, but several of Sandy's friends and her sister Donna told investigators that Sandy had told them the father was her ex-husband, Ralph. According to their statements, Sandy and Ralph had begun an affair after their divorce, and it was through this affair that Sandy became pregnant. I should note, I haven't found any public statements wherein Ralph denies being the father, but there are very few public statements from him at all. It's specified that the child's paternity can't be confirmed, primarily since the unborn child went missing with his mother. In an August 16th news article, Ralph spoke to the Democrat and Chronicle, explaining that he had been questioned by investigators on multiple occasions. Ralph, who had a child born just 5 days before Sandy's disappearance, expressed that the entire situation had led to a lot of speculation, which was causing great difficulty for him and his family. Ralph went on to say that he had given police telephone and bank records which would account for his whereabouts on May 23rd, as well as several days before and after, though he did acknowledge that he saw Sandy that morning. Police later acknowledged that Ralph had in fact submitted to questioning on two separate occasions, but they noted when he arrived for the third interview, he was accompanied by his lawyer, Ronald Valentine. At this point, Ralph was asked to take a polygraph test, which he refused to do under the advice of his lawyer. Police then requested permission to search Ralph's property, located just a few miles north of Sandy's apartment, but again, they were denied. Interestingly, Ralph's lawyer later told a reporter, quote, he did cooperate with them, gave them access to everything. They simply had nothing to indicate there was any wrongdoing on his part, end quote. Investigator Bowling, though, noted that while Ralph had spoken to the Macedon police, he never spoke with the state police, saying, quote, Sandra Solly's ex-husband remains a suspect, because on the advice of his attorney, he has never talked with state police, end quote. That, though, was later contradicted by Lieutenant Barry Chase of the New York State Police, who addressed the rumors around Ralph, saying, quote, obviously, he, along with several other people, were interviewed regarding this. I know there's always been some speculation, but he was never a suspect, end quote. In September of 1994, a robbery turned lethal and two people were shot and killed in an alley near Penfield. As details emerged, it was revealed that one of the victims was 24-year-old Vicky Solly, Ralph's sister and Sandy's former sister-in-law. While police initially probed the investigation wondering if there could be any direct connections between the double homicide and Sandy's disappearance, they were ultimately able to track down and arrest those responsible, a couple of teenagers. It was their belief that there was no connection between the two cases, and witnesses who knew both Sandy and Vicky noted that the two had never been close and never really spent any time together. 3 months later, in December, police once again conducted a helicopter search of the Erie Canal. The search, which lasted 90 minutes, flew over a 10-mile stretch of the canal and, like previous searches, had no results. State Police investigator Robert Fennis later told reporters that this would likely be the last search of the canal, noting, quote, we've made a couple of passes up and down the canal. Our feeling is, with all the traffic on the canal, searches by divers, and today's aerial search, we've covered it pretty well. We conducted a thorough check. The water is fairly clear. If there had been something, a body, we would have seen it, end quote. Chief Ellis of Macedon acknowledged that while they will continue searching, they had absolutely no leads at the time. While Sandy's case was turning colder with each passing day, the investigation into the abduction of Kaylee Poulton was also beginning to wane. A case which had at one point received as many as 200 tips per day was down to just a few per month. Investigators acknowledged that both cases were still active and being worked, but there wasn't much left to do. In both instances, they believed the answers would likely develop through someone in the community who possessed knowledge about one crime or the other. In Kaylee's case, that would prove to be true, but it wouldn't happen for nearly 2 years. The tragic news came in August of 96. Former security guard Mark Christie confessed to police that he had abducted and strangled 4-year-old Kaylee the night she disappeared. He then led investigators to the child's remains, which had been placed inside of a 30,000-gallon water tank. Christie, who had lived near the Poultons, had in the past spoken to her parents and made references to how pretty he thought she was. Kaylee's mother, Judy Gifford, spoke to the South Coast Today News and explained, quote, "I always suspected him, but police said they checked him out and there just was nothing there that pointed a finger to him. How wrong we all were. Sometimes the evidence is not there." End quote. For Sandy's family, they felt terrible for the Poultons, though to some degree, there was a sense of longing. While they now had closure, as terrible as it was, Sandy's family was still wondering. Nancy explained, quote, "It's the not knowing that's the hardest part. There's nothing to describe it. Some days are better than others, but there's no peace. There won't be any until they call us and either tell us that they have found her and she's alive, or that she is not." End quote. Richard Ingram, a former corrections officer and 17-year private investigator, was watching the news in August of 96 when he saw the arrest of Mark Christie. During that broadcast, there was a mention of Sandy's case, and Ingram felt a swell of pity for Sandy's family. In hopes of helping, he reached out to the family and offered his services for just $1. Ingram began working his own investigation, though he would develop a relationship with state investigators on Sandy's case over the years. Ingram promised Sandy's family that he would not stop looking, and around the time he was coming into the case, a new team of investigators was assigned by the state police. Members of the state police violent crime interdiction team came in with fresh eyes and new perspectives to examine the case once again from the beginning. In October of 96, tracking dogs were brought in from Canada to once again try and detect any trace of Sandy along the banks of the canal, as well as going back over every place connected to the case, from Sandy's apartment to the car wash to West Wayne Plaza and everything in between. It was hoped that a new approach might detect something which had been previously missed. Unfortunately, despite these efforts, there were no major developments. Soon, days turned to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years. Every year on May 23rd, Richard Ingram arrives at West Wayne Plaza, one of the last places Sandy was seen alive. He hands out flyers and talks about Sandy's case in an attempt to keep the story alive. As the years have gone by, people tend to forget, and for Ingram and Sandy's family, keeping her name alive may be their one hope of finding the truth. Ingram expressed the importance of keeping the pressure on, never allowing the person responsible to believe they've given up. In terms of where to look, Ingram told the Democrat and Chronicle, quote, "I have a rule. Always look at the in-laws before you look at the outlaws in a case like this. It's always someone close." End quote. Sadly, on January 3rd, 2008, nearly 14 years after the disappearance of her daughter, Nancy passed away at the age of 80. Nancy had never given up the belief that the truth would eventually be discovered, though in the later years of her life, she withdrew from the public eye due to health issues and stress. Donna later commented that her mother was never the same after Sandy disappeared, and that her smile and laugh were less and less common, and more often than not, replaced by tears and sadness. Sandy's nephew, Michael Glow, was 22 when his aunt vanished. He was close with Sandy, and over the years has struggled with and been frustrated by the lack of developments. In hopes of bringing his family closer together while also engaging the community, he managed to arrange for a candlelight vigil in May of 2014. Balloons were released on which they had written special messages for Sandy. No funeral had ever been held. There'd be no proper way to say goodbye. But it seemed this might be a way to say something different, that they hadn't yet, nor would they ever, give up trying to find her. Sadly, just 5 months later, on October 3rd, Sandy's father, Dominic, passed away. He was 89. Dominic and Nancy were interred together, and as a way of giving them a piece of Sandy, her name was also etched into their tombstone. In October of 2016, police finally had the ability to search a parcel of land they'd been wanting to search since 1994. The property, located on Widerick Road in Macedon, was owned by Ralph Solly at the time of Sandy's disappearance, but he wouldn't give them permission. In 2016, that property was sold, and the new owners gave police their permission for a new search. 6 canine units were brought in for the land search, while 4 divers arrived to go into a pond located there. When asked about the new search, New York State Trooper Mark O'Donnell told the Democrat and Chronicle, quote, "There wasn't anything in particular that let us out here, other than this is where she was last seen before she went missing. We want closure for her family, and we want to bring this case to a successful conclusion. When we have a missing person, we continue to look for that person until we locate them." End quote. Unfortunately, after all that time, no new evidence was found during the search. It's been 26 years since Sandra Solly vanished from her home in Macedon, New York. Over those years, her family has struggled to accept the reality of the situation, and while hope remained for some time, they have had to bitterly accept the likelihood that Sandy is no longer alive. Both of her parents have since passed away, never knowing the truth, and while their children take up the case, so has Richard Ingram. On this case since 1996, Ingram is now 86 years old. Richard made a promise to find answers, and as far as he's concerned, that promise is unfulfilled, though he admits it's getting harder to continue as he gets older. When speaking with WHAM ABC News 13, he said, quote, "If you want to sleep better at night, you want to empty your guilty conscience, please call up and make arrangements to give us some information. It would give me closure, and I would feel like I can rest a little. It's constantly on my mind, practically every day." End quote. Sandra Ann Solly was last seen on May 23, 1994, in Macedon, New York. She's described as being a Caucasian female with brown hair and brown eyes, standing 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighing approximately 140 pounds. Sandy's ears are pierced. She has a birthmark on her abdomen and a scar on her upper lip. At the time of her disappearance, she was 7 months pregnant. If alive today, Sandy would be 64 years old, and her son would be 26. She also went missing with her charcoal poodle, Jesse. For everyone involved in Sandy's case, for as much as mysterious, there is one fact which remains clear. Someone out there knows what happened. Someone has the truth. And after all these years, it's time for that person to come forward and put an end to the pain and agony of unknowing. Her family longs to lay her to rest, to give her a proper burial and the dignity she deserves. It's their hope that someone will finally step forward and tell what they know, reveal the truth, and give them the answers they so desperately have sought. As Sandy's sister Donna has expressed, quote, "I really want to find my sister. I've been praying every day, and I'm not going to give up. Tell us where she is. We just want closure." Everyone wants to keep their home and family safe, Whether it's from a break-in, fire, flooding, or medical emergency, SimpliSafe Home Security delivers award-winning 24/7 protection. With SimpliSafe, you don't just get an arsenal of cameras and sensors. You get the best professional monitors in the business. They've got your back day and night, ready to send police, fire, or EMTs when you need them most. SimpliSafe delivers high-quality equipment that you can set up in minutes. It took me less than 30 minutes to secure my house, and that's provided me with hours of comfort. With SimpliSafe, I receive sensors for doors and windows and cameras to protect every corner of my home. One thing I really love about SimpliSafe is there's no long-term contract required, no hidden fees, and no installation costs. Plus, none of the equipment causes major damage to your home interior, no holes to patch up later or wires to contend with. Right now, my listeners get a free home security camera when you purchase a SimpliSafe system at simplisafe.com/trace. You also get a 60-day risk-free trial, so there's nothing to lose. Visit simplisafe.com/trace for your free security camera today. That's simplisafe.com/trace. Life can be stressful even under normal circumstances, and 2020 has certainly raised the bar. You need stress relief that goes beyond quick fixes, and that's Headspace. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations in an easy-to-use app. Headspace is one of the only meditation apps advancing the field of mindfulness and meditation through clinically validated research. So whatever the situation, Headspace really can help you feel better. Overwhelmed? Headspace has a 3-minute SOS meditation for you. Need some help falling asleep? Headspace has wind-down sessions their members swear by. And for parents, Headspace even has morning meditations you can do with your kids. Headspace's approach to mindfulness can reduce stress, improve sleep, boost focus, and increase your overall sense of well-being. As someone who isn't great at managing stress, I could certainly use some guidance, and Headspace made it both easy and fun. I love how simple it is to follow the guided meditation with just a tap, and the infographics made it completely stress-free. Headspace is backed by 25 published studies on its benefits, 600,000 five-star reviews, and over 60 million downloads. Headspace makes it easy for you to build a life-changing meditation practice with mindfulness that works for you on your schedule, anytime, anywhere. You deserve to feel happier, and Headspace is meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/trace. That's headspace.com/trace for a free 1-month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal offered right now. Head to headspace.com/trace today. A soon-to-be mother is setting plans into motion for the birth of her son, Brandon Michael. At 38 years old, Sandra Solly didn't bat an eye at becoming a single mother and raising her child alone. In fact, she embraced it and eagerly anticipated that moment. According to her sister Donna, with whom she was very close, Sandy had always wanted to be a mother. She was extremely happy and looking forward to the future. Then, one spring afternoon, she vanished without a trace. She was 7 months pregnant. The investigation got off to a rough start. It wouldn't be until June 5th that investigators actually took a missing persons report, only later to discover that Sandy hadn't been seen since May 23rd, nearly 2 weeks earlier. They were working from behind from the start, and to make things even more complicated, they had very little evidence to assess. Sandy's apartment was in good condition, her car was in the driveway, and there were no signs of a struggle, no indication of what could have happened. 26 years later, and not a great deal more information has been found. Over the years, police and Richard Ingram, a private investigator, have been fairly tight-lipped about anyone who may have been involved. While at least one former investigator described Sandy's ex-husband Ralph as a suspect, current investigators have disagreed. In fact, no one in an official capacity has ever named anyone as a suspect, and when asked about it, they have the same response. It's an active investigation, so they can't list people they've been looking into. Some articles, some interviews suggest that at different times, there have been 3 to 4 people who have garnered suspicion from police. However, like so much of this case, there's never been enough evidence to conclusively accuse or charge anyone. Disappearances are difficult enough to work with when you have evidence, but here, there's nothing. As far as we know, there's no fingerprints, blood, or DNA. There's no crime scene, as multiple investigators have pointed out. After all this time, there aren't even that many theories, and those which do exist are extremely similar. For the most part, people tend to believe one of two different scenarios. Either Sandy got into a car with someone or was forced into a car with someone she didn't know, or she went along with someone she thought she could trust, who turned out to have lethal intentions. While no remains have been found, after 26 years and not a single shred of information to suggest Sandy is still out there, almost everyone associated with the case believes she is deceased, and likely has been since May 23rd. So let's begin with the possibility that this could have been a stranger situation, and then make our way into the possibility of someone Sandy knew. We don't have much to work with in terms of a stranger abduction. Hell, we don't have much to work with no matter what your theory is. According to investigators, they believe whatever happened, Sandy got into a car with her killer. Now, over the years, that's been presented as her willingly doing so, but no one really knows for sure. Being that her keys were left behind and she took her dog with her, it's been theorized that she had to have known the driver. Sandy wasn't in the habit of taking her dog along with strangers. But we also know that Sandy walked her dog right near her home, often along the train tracks or by the canal. There's certainly a possibility she could have run into someone while walking the dog. Maybe someone who pulled a weapon on her and made her come along, or someone who pulled up asking for directions and found a way to force her into a car. No signs of a struggle were found in her apartment, and there doesn't appear to be anything found outside, but more than 10 days passed before police began investigating, and weather surely could have affected any outdoor evidence. I should note something which has given me a lot of confusion throughout this case. While a majority of reports indicate that Sandy was last seen at her home, there are some which say she was last seen at the former Ames Plaza, now West Wayne Plaza, which was approximately 1.2 miles to the southwest of the duplex, just across the Erie Canal. Why exactly that discrepancy exists, I can't say for sure, but it could certainly change the details of her disappearance to some degree. At one point, when playing cards were created which showed images and details of missing persons, Sandy was listed as having disappeared from Route 31, which is the road on which the plaza sits. I'd imagine it's believed Sandy disappeared from her apartment because her car was found parked there, and the only items missing were her purse and her dog. It looks as if she was heading out, maybe waiting to be picked up, and never made it home. There's several major roadways not far from the area, and so it's been theorized that someone could come along and abduct Sandy, whether she was outside of her home, walking her dog near the canal, or towards the plaza. They easily could have exited that area quickly and been hundreds, if not thousands, of miles away by the time an actual investigation took place. When we're looking at the stranger theory, we do have a couple of angles to consider. Simply because someone may have been a stranger to Sandy doesn't mean she was a stranger to that person. Sandy's home wasn't exactly right out in the open. It's on a cul-de-sac off the main road, and you can hardly see the home from that main strip. It doesn't seem like the kind of place someone would just be randomly passing by and happen to notice a woman by herself to abduct. We know that Sandy was an extremely nice person who got to know a lot of different people. She used to drive an elderly man around so he could get his errands done, and her childhood friend said she was the type to do anything for anyone. Surely, someone could have learned about that and exploited it. While at least one friend described Sandy as a homebody, others have discussed that prior to her pregnancy, she used to hang out at some local bars, including one Kaylee Poulton's father used to frequent, so the idea that someone could have developed an unrequited crush is certainly there. I imagine Sandy dated from time to time in the 5 years she lived in the duplex, so whether or not there could be a guy who wanted more than she was willing to offer is a possibility that can't be denied. Prior to her injury, she was working for Eastman Kodak, which has several locations in Rochester, just about 30 minutes to the west. Maybe a coworker could have stopped by for a visit, or had made prearranged plans to get together. One detail which has always bothered me revolves around Sandy's keys. Multiple reports state that the keys to her car and home were inside the house, which was locked when police arrived. I've always wondered if it was possible that the reason Sandy brought her dog along wasn't because she knew and trusted somebody, but because she had accidentally locked herself out while walking the dog. If no one was around, maybe she'd need to call for a ride. She didn't have a cell phone, so she'd need to get to a payphone, and maybe the nearest one was on the main drag. We know police questioned a few people multiple times. We just don't know who those people are. In one instance, in August of 95, investigators went down to Virginia to question a man who had previously dated Sandy. And while nothing came out of that, I don't think it's entirely possible to say this couldn't have been someone she knew, for even a short period of time that maybe friends and family didn't know about. That seems far more likely than a situation where it's just completely random, but stranger things have happened. The fact of the matter is, being 7 months pregnant, she's been described as being visibly pregnant, which to me adds an extra level of viciousness to her abductor, as they would have known. To some, though, that might have been seen as a weak spot to target. I find it interesting that some of Sandy's belongings were found in Penfield, and then her wallet is found in Rochester. This shows whoever dumped the items heading in a western direction. The question ultimately becomes, was this person disposing of items along the way wherever he was going next, or were they left at those locations to purposefully divert the investigation? I tend to lean towards the former, as if you wanted to throw off the investigation, I feel like a dumpster is a strange place to put something you want someone to find. If we move towards someone Sandy knew and trusted, there's a lot of possibilities there. Friends, co-workers, former boyfriends. While everything I've looked at in this case always suggests the likelihood that Sandy's abductor was male, I don't think you can completely dismiss the possibility that a female could have been involved, especially if it was someone Sandy had developed a friendship with, someone she spent time with. Judging from the information police have released, we know messages were left on Sandy's answering machine in the days following her disappearance. None of those messages has ever been released, but no one has ever stated that any of those messages suggested a meetup or a get-together. However, we have seen cases in which women have abducted other women who were pregnant because they wanted their child. This theory is sort of like the stranger theory. Sure, someone who knew Sandy could have come by. She gets in the car, they drive off, and by the time she realizes something's wrong, it's too late. There's a lot of places in that area to commit a crime and conceal a body. From forests to rivers and lakes. Hell, Lake Ontario is only 15 miles to the north of Sandy's duplex. I've seen a lot of speculation that she could have ended up in there, and it's a dark possibility we can't deny. Lake Ontario is 193 miles long, 53 miles wide, and has a maximum depth of 802 feet. Trying to search there would be an overwhelming challenge. On May 23rd, the only meeting we know Sandy had was with her ex-husband, Ralph. According to friends and family, Sandy would be meeting with Ralph to discuss something about the car. After their divorce, Ralph was required to pay for the car, and this has been listed as a major source of contention. At the same time, we're told that Sandy and Ralph had been carrying on an affair after their divorce, an affair which Donna and several others claim resulted in Sandy's pregnancy. While somewhat contradictory, these two situations, romance and fighting, are not always completely separate. For a lot of people, Ralph has become their primary target, and it's hard to blame them. The spouse or ex-spouse is almost always one of the key focal points of an investigation like this. If Ralph is the father of Sandy's unborn child, that adds another level of complexity. It wouldn't be difficult to imagine if they would argue about the cost to upkeep a car, the argument about the birth of a child would be a lot more complicated and heated, especially with Ralph married to a different woman. When it comes down to him, There's a handful of things people typically look at to suggest his involvement. That he hired a lawyer and never spoke with state police, that he refused to take a polygraph, and that he wouldn't allow investigators to search his property. Property which was located just a few miles from Sandy's home. In terms of questioning, I don't necessarily think that hiring a lawyer suggests guilt. Reportedly, Ralph spoke with investigators twice before he lawyered up, so maybe he was just getting the sense that, as the ex-husband, they were starting to look at him as a suspect, and he wanted to protect himself. When it comes to a polygraph, hell, I wouldn't take one even if it was about the most insignificant issue, let alone a possible abduction and murder scenario. I guess the one place where I stumble is searching property. I feel like if my pregnant ex-wife was missing, I'd probably let the police have a look around. For whatever reason, though, that doesn't happen here, and police didn't get to search that property for 22 years. Although when they did, they didn't find anything. For the most part, Ralph hasn't said much about this case. He says he gave police both bank and phone records for the day of the disappearance, as well as the days surrounding it, and he doesn't feel like there's any issues. He told one newspaper that he felt pretty good about where he stood with authorities, noting that he had evidence to show he was nowhere near Sandy that afternoon. He admitted to meeting with her, though the details of that encounter have never been revealed by anyone. This meeting, though, allegedly took place in the morning, and as we know, the last confirmed sighting of Sandy was around 2:30 p.m. After all these years, looking at all the evidence they have, or should I say, what little evidence they have, police have never been able to gather enough to even name Ralph as a person of interest, let alone a suspect, which means one of two things. Either he performed this crime in such a way as to leave nothing behind, or he wasn't involved. I already know I'm going to get a ton of emails and comments from people telling me that he had to be involved, and I understand that, but when you're looking at evidence, you've really got nothing there. Not enough for a charge, not enough for an accusation. I've never found a comment or a statement from any of Sandy's family throwing any kind of shade at Ralph outside of the claim that he was the child's father. None of them has ever accused him of being involved in her disappearance. Whether that's because they don't believe he is, or they don't want to mess up the investigation, we just don't know. So what do you think? Is this a random crime perpetrated by a total stranger? One carried out by someone Sandy knew? Or could her ex-husband be behind it? I'd really love to know your thoughts. At the end of the day, this is a horrifying disappearance that resulted not only in Sandy being taken from her family, but also her child. This isn't just a missing persons case. Two lives were involved here, and while Sandy was robbed of the opportunity to have her son, her family was robbed of seeing her become the mother she had always dreamed of being. Brandon Michael would have been her parents' eighth grandchild, and right as they were preparing to celebrate at a baby shower, they instead were forced into this darkness from which there's no true escape. No matter how much hope or longing or desire there is to uncover the truth, nothing is going to bring Sandy and Brandon back. Instead, where there should have been joy, there's only been sorrow. This May will mark 27 years since Sandy disappeared. Both of her parents have passed away without ever knowing the truth, without ever seeing justice. Her siblings today continue to advocate for her life and do what they can to bring attention to her case, which has sadly been widely forgotten or ignored. Richard Ingram is getting older, and while he'd like to keep his promise to work Sandy's case to the very end, his opportunity to do so shrinks each and every day. Despite this, Richard, Sandy's family, and current investigators all believe that there are people out there that know the truth, people who have yet to come forward. Sadly, unless they do, or new evidence is discovered, the disappearance of Sandra Solly will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Sandra Solly, there are many news articles from 1994 that dig into this case, specifically from The Democrat and Chronicle. There's also several interviews with members of Sandy's family, as well as statements made by private investigator Richard Ingram. If you have any information about the disappearance of Sandra Solly, please contact the New York State Police Troop E headquarters at 585-398-4123. You can also contact private investigator Richard Ingram at 585-465-8769, or you can email him at relentlesspi@gmail.com. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. Did you know that CrimeCon is coming to the United Kingdom and will be in London on June 12th and 13th, 2021? And I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. I'm really looking forward to being a part of this amazing event. And if you're considering going, you can use the promo code TRACE21 for 10% off your ticket. That's TRACE21 for 10% off. Visit crimecon.co.uk for more information. Trace Evidence would not be possible without the amazing support of you incredible listeners. So I'd like to take a moment to thank our amazing Patreon producers. Special thanks to Alicia Lorraine, Ann Bertram, Astrid Nyer, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, D'Earthy, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kevin Bonham, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar-Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Mascaritolo, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. You're all amazing and your contributions are greatly appreciated, as are all patrons. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or visit trace-evidence.com for further information. That's going to wrap things up for this week, but I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.